Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Jim, we start with the good. And with all the upheaval going on with different officials in the Trump administration, one of the people I don't think we've ever had anything negative to say about in almost a year and a half now is UN Ambassador Nikki Haley. And the reason for that is because she's doing a great job. She's making crystal clear and powerful statements on a number of key issues. And that's the focal point of our good martini today. She was giving a speech down at Duke University, and she was talking about America's role in the world and how it has to stand up to the anti-Israel mob at the United Nations and a lot of other things. She also talked about the Iran nuclear deal as being designed to be too big to fail. We'll see if that's actually the case. But first of all, here's Nikki Haley on America's ability to lead in the world.
United States leadership doesn't have to involve military action. Our most effective leadership is, in fact, when we lead by example, when we embrace the fact that we are a special nation with a special message to the world. Each of us, every single one of us, has God-given rights that cannot legitimately be denied. This test of American leadership arises at the United Nations quite often.
And she says that's because the United Nations has a special penchant for singling out Israel and trying to punish Israel for a variety of things when there are far worse actors around the world. And Israel's actions are certainly debatable if they're bad actions at all. So, Jim, here's what she says about this U.S. administration being different perhaps than prior administrations on that front.
This is not because previous ambassadors and administrations didn't believe in freedom, democracy, and human rights. It's because it's often just easier not to rock the boat. When the crowd is all going one way, it's sometimes hard to be the only one going in the other direction. But in America, we don't celebrate the mob. We celebrate the person who has the courage and conviction to stand up to the mob.
So what is this administration doing as the UN keeps focusing on Israel?
So we've begun to use the monthly Middle East meeting to talk about the real sources of conflict in the region. Iran, Assad, ISIS, Hezbollah, Hamas. And we've made it clear to the Human Rights Council that either it will change or it will pursue its biased agenda without the United States as a member. We've made these changes to have the back of our friend and ally Israel, absolutely. But we're also sending the message that the era of the United States leading from behind is over.
Jim, you can't get much clearer than that.
Two thoughts as I listened to Nikki Haley speak there. The first is, whatever traditional conservatives thought of the Trump administration and Trump, and particularly in the realm of foreign policy, President Trump could one minute say we should go in and take the oil, that we're going to bomb the you-know-what out of ISIS. And then he could turn around and say, you know, we sound quasi-isolationist. We've spent too much money over there. It's time to get out. Let somebody else deal with the problem, et cetera. You could get some conflicting signals. And I think when Trump speaks, he speaks honestly. I think he feels one way one moment and in response to one set of events. And then he feels differently the next moment, depending on how things are going. From Nikki Haley, we are getting what traditional conservatives wanted to see and hear after the Obama administration. And I think the gentle, some might even say too gentle rebuke to her predecessors, Samantha Power, Susan Rice, folks like that, is just the right note, I would say. I think it was kind of embarrassing the way the United States would not stick up for Israel at the UN, the way we would pressure them, the way we got pushed around at the UN. There is a new sheriff in town, so to speak. And man, oh man, they really... It's ruffling some feathers up there, but I think in the right way. We've actually seen a decent number of victories on this. We are now speaking forthright. And you know, there was always this mentality of the Obama administration and generally out of Democratic and left-of-center administrations that if you just reach out enough, you'll get better behavior for some of these states, whether it's North Korea, whether it's Iran, whether it's Cuba. And no matter how many times that blows up in their faces, you know, I guess the thinking that they're going to be de Klerk and Mandela They're going to be the negotiators in Northern Ireland. If you reach out to your enemy and you actually do reach a lasting peace, then yes, you win the Nobel Peace Prize and you're remembered as a great peacemaker for all time. But in a lot of cases, the opposition will just bite your hand off, right? They will take advantage of you. They will think of you as being gullible when you reach out like that. And that, I think, plagued a great deal of the Obama administration's approach to these sorts of rogue threats, rogue nations, things like that. And it's just that era is over, and it's just a refreshing delight out of up in Turtle Bay at the United Nations.
Certainly the case. So let's move to the bad martinis. One very briefly, this is more in passing than the official bad martini. Most folks know on Twitter or beyond that Kevin Williamson, who was with National Review Online for a good decade, left to become a columnist at The Atlantic. There was initially a firestorm there from certain folks on staff, which led to the editor, Jeffrey Goldberg, to say, look, I know he holds views that a lot of you find objectionable, but we're not going to let a couple of lines here and there from a voluminous amount of work be a problem in allowing a variety of voices come to our pages. Well, Kevin Williamson is now out at The Atlantic. Another statement from Jeffrey Goldberg basically saying that one of Kevin's most controversial tweets was also a centerpiece of a podcast discussion in which Kevin explained his views on the subject of the death penalty and abortion. The language he used in the podcast and in my conversations with him in recent days made it clear that the original tweet did in fact represent his carefully considered views. Goes on to say he's a gifted writer and has been nothing but professional in our interactions, but I have come to the conclusion that The Atlantic is not the best fit for his talents, and so we are parting ways. And so there's been a lot of pieces, Jim, you've written about this, David French wrote about it, and others, about how the idea of differing views is less and less welcome in the pages of supposedly journals that would want to attract a wide spectrum of opinion.
I didn't want to dwell on this. I fumed and you know, talked about it with my friend Cam Edwards yesterday. I don't want to come across as a guy who's obsessive about this because of, you know, my high esteem for Kevin, but I'll make just, you know, one or two quick points. One is that if you really find Kevin Williamson's views so objectionable that they cannot appear in your magazine, and you know, running his column, even if he doesn't write about abortion, that somehow he's going to sully the good name of The Atlantic, which ran, by the way, I believe was the home of Andrew Sullivan when he was in the Trig Trutherism days. You know, basically when he was speculating that Sarah Palin had not actually had Trig Palin and that there'd been this elaborate effort to cover up another pregnancy of one of her daughter. You know, like you're allowed to be crazy at The Atlantic, clearly. Just not that kind of crazy. You know, don't hire him. I think to hire him and decide a week later, oh, wait, we've decided you're too controversial for us. Sorry. Is a absolutely gutless thing to do. I think the most simplest explanation here is that Jeffrey Goldberg knuckled under to the mob. He doesn't really run The Atlantic anymore. It is the most vocal complainer in the newsroom or outside who basically has veto power over Jeffrey Goldberg's decisions now. Secondly, let's be clear. One of the slogans of The Atlantic is without favor for party or clique. I think that's total nonsense now. I keep hearing, well, why doesn't National Review hire any liberals? Well, we're an explicitly conservative magazine. Now, the great irony is we have a great deal of debate within libertarians and social conservatives and populists. And, you know, you see a lot of internal debate at National Review, a lot in the pages of National Review. Jonah and Ramesh and Rich are having an argument about Trump and populism right now. So we can have lots of different viewpoints within ours. Apparently, The Atlantic can't do that. That's too much to ask, even though they keep touting themselves. Oh, we're not a liberal magazine. We're not Mother Jones, The Nation, something like that. It's just one of those things where I think now this is an effort to decide that certain perspectives are beyond the pale. And that is basically that, not just this comment of Kevin Williamson, but I think Kevin Williamson as a person is now becoming an unperson. He's being written out. No respectable magazine should have someone like Kevin Williamson on it. And, you know, Greg, you know, I don't think you and I are that far away from it. If he's beyond the pale, if we're either beyond the pale or on our way, we're brushing right up against it. And there's an effort to move the pale one more giant step to the left again. So that's where we are, and I'll stop, because otherwise I could just, you know, froth at the mouth for the rest of the day about this.
Oh, we've seen it for years now. It's not okay to think A, B, and C, and that is a very chilling thing, whether it's on the pages of The Atlantic or even just in regular society. But let's move on quickly to our official bad martini, and that's that the trade spat with China is perhaps only escalating here. Two parts to this. First of all, from CNBC, if the U.S. goes through with an additional $100 billion in tariffs, which Trump has threatened, China will not hesitate to fight back and is already prepared to, a Ministry of Commerce representative said. Quote, we will immediately fight back with a major response. We have no other choice. We feel America is very arrogant. They have taken a wrong action. The result is that they will hurt themselves. If they release the list of $100 billion tariffs, China is prepared and will not hesitate. And, oh, by the way, they have the Trump card. I mean that literally and figuratively here, because China held around $1.17 trillion of treasuries at the end of January, making it the largest of America's foreign creditors and number two overall owner of U.S. government bonds after the Federal Reserve. That's a fancy way to say that they hold a lot of our debt, and they could at some point just say, hey, bill's due. So, Jim, this is getting deeper, and I'm not sure where it's headed.
It's a little unnerving to hear comments from the president, comments from our old friend Larry Kudlow, insisting, look, the stock market's going to, this is, you know, we're going to go through a rough patch, but it's going to get better, which was his comments yesterday. Apparently, more comments he made on, I believe, it's CNBC or somewhere else earlier this morning, despite the assurances of Peter Navarro that no one would dare impose retaliatory sanctions. China went right ahead and did it. They're not afraid of losing access to the U.S. market. They're clearly signaling from this, we can do more, guys. Trump will not back down one iota. I think he feels that it's something, whether you can say a game of chicken or a game of attrition. You know, Trump is convinced that the steel and aluminum tariffs will inflict more pain on China than the pain that will be inflicted on farmers and airplane makers and things like that. You know, maybe not. It's really bad luck if you're a farmer and you're planning on getting your soybeans or your pork products over to China. It's really bad news for Boeing. It's really bad. I mean, you know, there's people are going to get hit by this, but the Trump ad is, don't worry, at some point Beijing is going to flinch and they're going to knuckle under and they'll stop supporting their steel and aluminum industries the way we don't like. And that eventually we will work this out and the stock market will rebound and everything will be fine. That's that happy ending is not so clear from here. It really seems to calculate that we can outlast China and that they will eventually want, you know, that they're not afraid. The fact that they're, you know, threatening to escalate says to me China thinks they've got the better hand here. And we will see how it shakes out. But this does not indicate that, you know, whether, you know, I keep hearing people in the administration insisting it's not a trade war, Greg. So at this point, there's no indication that the trade police action will continue. We'll stop at any given moment.
Great. All right. Well, the soaring stock market was fun while it lasted. Good luck with your 401k, everybody. All right. On to the crazy martini now, Jim. And what we need in a time of such political upheaval is a calm, steady, some would say boring hand of competence. And if you're looking for a good candidate to support for governor in Minnesota, you might have just found your man. Again, for the third time, because Tim Pawlenty, the two-term Republican governor of Minnesota from 2003 to 2011, is running again here in 2018. Here's a bit of his announcement video.
Skyrocketing healthcare costs and cost of college and just trying to afford a decent life are overwhelming too many. But there's no better place to create a better way forward than right here. But toxic politics are dividing us. I have the strength and the experience to solve problems and bring us together. My top priority will be to put those in the middle who are working hard and getting squeezed first.
And already Larry Sabato has moved this race to toss-up. Jim, we've got Mitt Romney running for Senate, Tim Pawlenty running for governor. All we need is Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum to run for something, and it's 2012 all over again.
I was going to say, Greg, what's Herman Cain doing these days? Cater the whole thing with pizza. You know, here's I say this. I, you know, I like Tim Pawlenty. Actually, for a while, he was doing a podcast for us at National Review. Always a very pleasant guy to cover, straight shooter, pretty solid conservative. And, you know, back in 2012, I had, you know, look, I like Scott Walker, right? I mean, I have no problems with boring. Boring is exciting in my world. Slight disappointment he chose to run for governor and not for Senate. Obviously, you know, the Republicans want to put as many seats in play. And, you know, a former governor is, in, by most measures, a pretty darn solid. A guy who's won two statewide races is usually a pretty good sign. A little surprising he wants to go back to governor. The other thing, nagging doubt I have is, you know, Pawlenty won fine. He came after the excitement, the roller coaster that was Jesse Ventura. Yes. And it could very well be that Minnesota has said, you know what, we've had enough excitement. This bland guy is just fine. And it's also worth noting, you know, Tim Pawlenty always felt that he stood up for a certain sense of Sam's Club Republicanism, quasi-populist blue-collar conservatism, that he was not a traditional one. Now, he spent, you know, a couple of years working for some very lucrative work in the private sector. I don't begrudge the man that. I think some will say, oh, that kind of undermines his populist cred. But it's kind of interesting, the argument of whether Pawlenty was not in terms of style, but in terms of kind of governing philosophy, not that different from Donald Trump. Now, personality-wise, they're about as far different as they can get. But they're kind of this interesting to see, you know, can populism work when it's divorced from Trumpism? I have my doubts. We've seen other folks try to do the Trump shtick, and they did not have several decades of being a you know, non-political business and pop culture celebrity the way Donald Trump had accumulated before he ran in 2016. And I'm not sure, my sneaking suspicion is that if populism was this natural underserved audience, that there was this great appetite for it out there, that that Trump had kind of discovered, you know, my sneaking suspicion is that somebody else would have tried this. And in fact, that was kind of the theme of the Tim Pawlenty campaign in 2012. I understand if listeners forgot that Tim Pawlenty ran for president in 2012. He was not in the race for very long, but that's how things have shaken out. So I hope to see Governor Tim Pawlenty. I do wonder about this being a tough blue year, the quote-unquote blue wave that is accumulating. He certainly will make the race more competitive than various other Minnesota Republicans. If he wins, it'll be a really pleasant surprise for Republicans. But I just don't want to bet a lot on anybody winning this year. Although it is worth noting that Trump came within only a few points in Minnesota. And people are saying that in that upper Midwest, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, that Minnesota was the next state that kind of had the demographics that could shift like that.
Well, we will see. It's interesting how you compared him to Trump. I think Pawlenty and shtick are not two words that we would normally put together.
He's anti-shtick.
Yes, exactly. So we will see. Your move, like you said, Herman Cain, Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, whoever else was in that campaign. You still got some time in some of these states to get on the ballot. Jim, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday.
See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Have a great weekend, everyone. Follow us on Twitter. He's at Jim Garrity. I'm at Dateline_DC. And tune in again Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.